Book of Psalms. We've done this before, kind of a summer thing, take some time to spend in the Psalms. And I've always enjoyed doing that. The Psalms are these poems that for a long time for God's people, this was the worship. They would sing the Psalms. They would pray the Psalms. The Psalms would guide their prayer. There's so much that God has for us in them. And in fact, my favorite preacher ever, a guy named Charles Spurgeon, who's like around in the 1800s, but amazing author, writer, preacher, just the best. He wrote a commentary on the Psalms that he called Treasury of David. King David wrote many of the Psalms. He wrote the one that we're looking at this morning. And he was, I mean, he's the king, but he's also a poet and he's a warrior and a man after God's own heart in that these are the treasures that he's left behind for us. I love that. And so we're going to spend the next 5 weeks or a total of 5 weeks in the Psalms. And then after that, we're going to preach the book of Malachi. Malachi is a prophet. In fact, he's the last prophet before Jesus. And so looking forward to that. For those of you who like to read ahead, that is what you can read ahead. Now, because of what the Psalms are about as a whole and what the Psalm in particular that we're reading today is about, I'd like to start us off with a quote, which I've heard many times from like various preachers. It's a well-used quote, but for good reason. It's by an author named David Foster Wallace. It's from a commencement speech that he gave, and he was not a Christian, and I think that he did spend some time exploring Christian faith. But here's what he says in this commencement speech at a college graduation. He says this: in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And he's making an observation about human behavior and human nature, that this thing that we understand is worship, that whole idea of worship, there's a whole collection of things wrapped up in that, a bunch of behaviors and attitudes. So you sacrifice for the thing that you worship. You dedicate your life to the pursuit of the thing that you worship. You get your sense of purpose and significance from the thing you worship. You get answers about what matters most in life from the thing that you worship, and you get answers about what is right or wrong or acceptable or unacceptable from the thing that you worship. Those are behaviors that are found in every single person. Everybody worships something. It's how God made us. God created and designed our hearts to give themselves over to something higher than us, which in his design is him. But we don't always do that. We take things that are not God and we raise them to that ultimate position in our hearts. And that's what we call an idol. An idol is an object of worship that's not God. And so lots of people can turn money into their idol, or their own beauty can become an idol for them. Your kids can become an idol. Your job can become an idol. It could be anything. It could be your favorite political leader. It could be a music artist that you really like. Anything that you make ultimate in your heart. Everybody worships. And that's another way of saying that everybody follows something. Everyone's being led by something. Something has an overwhelmingly powerful influence over you. The message that comes from it, you find compelling. There are people who think they're not worshiping anything or following after anything, or I'm not influenced by anything. I'm just a rational person. I just think through and I just make my decisions, and that's the way that I live. But those people are wrong, and I'll explain why a bit later. What is it that you think most people are following? I know there's a bunch of things that it could be. What do you think most people are being influenced by? What's the message that is resonating and compelling people in how they choose to live their lives? What do you follow? What's the message that you find compelling that influences how you live? We're going to get into it now. Psalm 23 is our psalm for today. It's a short one, so we'll read it all at once. Psalm 23 says this, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever." So let's talk about it. This is, again, Psalm of David, fairly well-known one. And it begins, "The Lord is my shepherd." And actually, if you get that verse up, it is there. Good. When you see "Lord" written out like that in the Old Testament, all capital letters, that is the translators letting you know the word they're translating into "Lord" is the name of God, Yahweh. Sometimes, if you just read "Lord" and it's just the first letter is capitalized, that is the Hebrew word Adonai. And I'm not actually sure if there are maybe other Hebrew words that some translators translate as "Lord." This is from the ESV, the English Standard Version. Every translation can be a little bit different in some ways, but most of them do this. And this is an important distinction. For one, it's just helpful to know when the name of God is being used rather than a title for God. Right? It's good for us and important for us sometimes to catch extra nuance when the name of God is being used. For another, this restrains us. Knowing this, that that's the name of God, the personal name of God revealed to Moses, it restrains us from doing this thing that I saw Oprah do one time on the Stephen Colbert show. Oprah was on Stephen Colbert, and she was talking about her favorite verse in the Bible, which is from Psalm 37, and it's the verse, "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." But when she describes what she thinks that means, she said, you know, "Lord" has a wide range. It could mean compassion, it could mean love and forgiveness and kindness. And in her words, so delight yourself in those virtues where the character of the Lord is revealed. So she uses "Lord" in Psalm 37. It's written the same way, all capitals. She uses that word "Lord" as a stand-in, kind of fill in the blank where anyone can put their own idea of some vague higher spiritual power or these virtues that are, you could say, are represented by God, and delight yourself in those good things, and that is what the Bible means here. The problem is, the verse says, "Delight yourself in Yahweh." It would be the same thing where if it were in the New Testament, we might expect it to read, "Delight yourself in Jesus." And so if you say, well, you don't really have to delight yourself in Jesus, just delight yourself in the goodness that he represents. It's not the same thing. It's a misuse of the Bible to substitute in something that you feel more comfortable with and to make it vague, to make it general, to make it so that anyone can kind of put their own idea of goodness onto that word. That's not what it is. Delight yourself in the Lord. The Lord is my shepherd, Yahweh. This is the God of the Bible, the God who reveals himself through his word, the God of Moses who brings the people out of slavery in Egypt, the God who establishes the nation Israel. That's the specific person we're talking about. This means the one who leads me, the one who is my shepherd, is the God of the Bible. He's the one who shows me my way. He's the one who I follow. That's what David says. Now, what is it like to follow him? What's it like to follow the God of the Bible? He describes it for us. And David himself is a shepherd, or he was a shepherd first before he later became king. So this is probably imagery that he's very familiar with. But he says, following the God of the Bible means you're following someone who cares for you and knows your needs and desires the best for you. I shall not want. I will have everything that I need in following Yahweh as my shepherd. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. Like in the good gifts that God gives to you, there is no danger. There is nothing to be cautious about in the things that God gives to you as these good gifts, these good provisions. You don't have to be cautious. You don't have to look out. You don't have to guess at his motives. He restores my soul. He leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. This is a departure from what shepherds do for their sheep, but it is what God does for his people. Because he's not just looking out for your physical needs, your physical well-being. He cares about your spiritual needs, your emotional needs. And he knows you deeply. He knows the hurt that you feel, that you carry around, all the anxieties and the worries that weigh you down. He knows the complicated choices that we face. And I don't know what's right. I don't know what I should do. He knows the regret and the guilt that we carry. And what does he do for us? He heals us. He forgives us. He removes the heavy burdens. He shows us the right path. If we would trust him enough to walk it, he sets it in front of us, the paths of righteousness. Shepherds want their sheep to feel safe and be well taken care of and happy. The job and the role of the shepherd is for the sake of the sheep. Now, having said that and having just recounted the first three verses, I want to be careful of giving anyone like a false impression or of anyone who might start saying, well, you know, that's a very kind of overly optimistic and naive view of things, that if you just follow God as your shepherd, you're just green pastures and still waters. Because Psalm 23 includes more than that. Even though following the God of the Bible is what David describes here, that does not mean it's always sunshine and rainbows. To be fair, the first three verses are as close to sunshine and rainbows as the Bible ever gets. But in verse 4, we get an acknowledgement that something is in fact wrong. Verse 4 is the dose of realism injected into Psalm 23 that doesn't let us pretend that if you just follow God, everything's going to be great, nothing that bad is ever going to happen, and your life is going to be pretty awesome. David says, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. Well, why does that happen? If God is your shepherd, if you're following him, how'd you end up there? It doesn't even sound like a real place, but there is like a death valley in the world now. I don't know if there was one then, but it sounds like not the place you want to be. It's not the green pastures. It's the place where like it's not strange for people to die in the valley of death, the valley of the shadow of death. What's the problem here? And the problem is, even if you follow God today, even if you choose to follow God today, or you've been walking with God for a long time, we did not always follow God. The very first time that we see humans as his creation who are made in his image, the very first time we see them depart from following God, turn away from him, is described in the book of Genesis. In chapter 3, we read this, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any other beast of the field the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say you shall not eat of any tree in the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, you shall not eat the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave some to her husband, who was with her, and he ate." And the serpent here is Satan. And Satan is able to convince Eve, as well as Adam, who is with her, and he also eats. God is not the best option for you to follow. And actually, God is holding out on you. He is holding you down, holding you back, and that you can become like God. You won't even need him anymore. You could be like God, and all you have to do is not listen to him. You don't have to listen to what he says. You can decide for yourself what's good and evil, what's right and wrong. And I imagine it as being kind of like an earworm that kind of burrows into your brain this thought, I don't need God. I can be like God. I don't have to listen to him. I can decide for myself. God doesn't know best. I know best. That's what takes root. See, the people who think they're not influenced by anything and they're just fully rational and make their own decisions, not influenced by anyone or anything, certainly not influenced by God, they're being deceived because they are walking out the path laid before them by Satan. Satan's goal is not to make everyone be like the movie The Exorcist, like a creepy possession kind of thing. Like, that's not the game plan. If that's the game plan, people would actually be afraid and would, like, look for protection in God. He would be driving people into the church. His goal is not that. His goal is not to get everyone super into the occult and, like, wear pentagrams and, like, dye your hair super black. And put crystals on altars and things like that. Some of that is fine, sure. Like, he's fine if that's what some people are going to end up doing. But the main goal that he has is very simple. It's just to turn us away from God in whatever way he can. And the simplest way is often the best. Just to get you to a place where you think, I don't need God. I don't need God. If that message resonates with you, if that compels you, we always follow someone. We just don't always follow God. He's so good at temptation, whispering into people's ears, just the same things that he did in Genesis 3. You don't have to listen to God. God doesn't know best. You can figure this out for yourself. You don't need him. You can make your own decisions. Satan is so good at encouraging people. He's possibly the best encourager that has ever walked the face of the earth. The problem is he's also at the same time lying to you. Because the result of Genesis 3 is not that they in fact did not need God and that they became like him and they got to achieve the great heights of being like God themselves. They were in the Garden of Eden, the place where their creator was, the place full of goodness and beauty and life. And because they listened to his lies, they were banished to go live into a world that would increasingly be afflicted by the curse of their own sin that they unleashed upon it. As more and more people who follow Adam and Eve continue to walk the same path, I don't need God, I don't have to listen to God, I can go my own way. More and more the order and the design of God breaks and falls apart. And it becomes to the point that it is what David describes, the valley of the shadow of death. We did not always follow God. We did always follow someone. Something. And like, it's not, you don't have to be a Satanist to like subscribe to the message that he is preaching to the world, because he has so many representatives who are passionate about his message. You know what Jesus calls those? The representatives of that message. In John 10, he talks about himself as the good shepherd, and he describes these representatives as the thieves and the hired hands. So John 10, verse 10 says this. This is Jesus speaking. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. Jesus calls himself the good shepherd. He's not like the thief who comes in an obvious way to steal and kill and destroy. Like, that is bad, obvious to everyone. He's also not like the hired hand. And the problem with the hired hand is they just don't actually care about the sheep. They care about being paid. They care about their own lives. They care about themselves. They don't care about the sheep. And I believe there are far, far more hired hands out there in the world than there are the thieves. Hired hands are the people who are going to be with you, but they care more about themselves and their own interests than they care about you and your own well-being. They're never going to take a loss on their self-interest for the sake of your well-being. Hired hands see the wolf. They see the source of destruction, the coming thing that is going to cause pain, and they get out of there. They won't step in between you and a wolf. And so if you're on a path that's headed for a wolf, headed for some destruction and loss and pain, they're going to let you keep walking rather than step in and do something about it. Affirmation, validation, telling you the things that you want to hear. You know, who cares about what God says? You don't need God. You're great on your own. Your way is great. You know best. Go do what you think is right. And then when that brings you to the valley of the shadow of death and you're hurt and you need help, they're not there. People like following the hired hand. People like to follow the same basic message of Satan because it lets you do whatever you want. The hired hand lets you go do whatever you want, and they never will tell you the truth about the consequences. There's a study that I saw that I just found so horrifying, and it was about the effect on a friend group. It was looking at women in friend groups. If one of the women in that friend group gets divorced, how that dramatically increases the chance for each of the other friends in that group to themselves also get divorced. And the study makes it clear this: it's not looking at cases where, like, she was being abused and she got the courage to leave and then they were all emboldened by that. That's not what the study's looking at. It's looking at you got bored in your marriage and then you went to go search for more excitement and then your friends thought, well, I want to have a more exciting life too. And strangely, in this study, it was the same phenomenon whether there were children in the home or not. And it's heartbreaking because, so I just did a wedding yesterday for a couple, Rob and Anna, and maybe you know them. They're friends with Mike and Rebecca, Mike who does our music sometimes, and they're great people. They kind of live a little bit far away. But I was doing their wedding yesterday, and my daughter, Amelia, was like in tears, begging, like, don't go, Dad, don't go, don't go. Do the wedding at home instead. Like, I can't do that. People are going to be real mad if I don't show up. And I thought to myself through that, it was like, it feels good that she likes me that much, but it was also like hard to leave when she's acting like that. And I just thought, like, as I was driving, I was like, I could never get divorced. Besides the fact that I love my wife and like everything is great between us. And like, that's not the only reason by any means. Like, I took vows and I take them serious and I like my wife. But like, if I were to listen to some of the preaching that the world does when it comes to marriage and divorce and the thing that like the message of the world is selfishness, unapologetic, bold, you deserve to be happy no matter what. Go get your own happiness. If you're not fully happy in your marriage, leave it. Go find what makes you happy. And like at the same time, kids are resilient. It'll be fine. It's better for them to see parents who are fully happy than to be in a home where the parents are together, which is nuts. Just devastating the ways that like in a thought experiment, how hurt my daughters would be and how unfair it would be that I drastically change the way that their lives look and that like 50% of the time I'm going to have to go through those tearful goodbyes and like for what? For my own selfish desire. And then there's like alimony and child support and who can pay that? So like lot of reasons. But again, the most important is I do love my wife. There are real, painful, long-term consequences to the decisions that we make, particularly to the selfish decisions we make where we ignore the paths of righteousness that God lays out, say, this is what marriage should look like, this is what commitment should look like, this is how you should treat people. When we ignore the paths of righteousness and we choose our own selfish direction, and we justify it in all different kinds of ways, it still will lead you to the valley of the shadow of death. It will hurt. It will not be good. And by contrast, following the Lord as your shepherd, the God of the Bible, following Jesus, the good shepherd, is very different. It feels different. It feels different because Jesus is never going to endlessly validate and affirm you in everything you want to do, in all the things that you already believe and think is right. You don't get to do whatever you want to do when Jesus is your shepherd. You don't get to choose the way. Jesus is the way. He makes his way known to us. You follow Jesus and you trust him enough to submit to his leadership in your life. That's why he says, following me, you have to take up your cross. You have to die to yourself. You have to self-sacrifice. There are some things you have to let go of. But he earns that level of trust from us where we're going to say, not my will done, your will be done. Maybe I don't fully understand it, but I'm going to trust you. You could believe the serpent or you could believe Jesus. The serpent says God is holding out on you. He's holding you back. He doesn't want the best for you. Jesus says, I came that you may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I know my own and my own know me. One of those two is lying. They can't both be telling the truth. Jesus earns our trust by going to the cross in our place. And by standing between us and the wolf, the source of destruction and pain and loss, the wolf that wants to destroy us, he stands in our place and he dies for us. Jesus is torn apart so that we could be put back together, so that we could be restored. And we could be led back onto the righteous paths. He brings us into a good place. And even though we are still going to experience times on this earth, in this life, of being in the valley of the shadow of death, he's still with us even there. He doesn't leave us just because we're there. He doesn't leave like the hired hand leaves. Verse 5, it says, you prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup overflows. Like in the presence of my enemies, in the very place where I should feel fear, and in front of the people who want to take everything from me, this is where Jesus makes it safe enough for me to sit down and he gives me the things that I need. He gives me good things. I could be filled with good things even in that place. And the image I see here is Jesus with his disciples before he goes to the cross. There he's in the presence of his enemies. He's surrounded. He knows what's coming. Judas himself is at the table who betrays him. Matthew 26, we read this. Now, as they were eating, Jesus took bread and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Jesus prepares a table for us. It's this table of grace, where we receive the grace of God. But the means by which we receive the grace of God is through the actions of Jesus, where his body is broken apart, so that we could be nourished and made whole.